Well, hello everybody. Welcome to Beyond the Matrix, the radio show for people who dare to think outside the box of convention. And we're going to be doing that big time tonight with animal activist and author Mark Hawthorne, whose book is going to blow you off the map. It's called Striking at the Roots, A Practical Guide to Animal Activism. And this is a subject that is very, very dear and close to my heart, as those of you who know me know. So before I introduce him and get him speaking to you, I would like you to know that his website is www.strikingattheroots.com. Take a note of it, but don't go there now or you'll miss hearing him speak, which is much more important. And later in the show, we'll have you calling in for questions for Mark. So Mark, thank you for being with me and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Patricia. Thanks for inviting me.
And it's really great because we have a wonderful connection, and sometimes it's not easy to do.
Yes.
Mark, it's really synchronistic that you're on tonight, because yesterday I rescued an animal who, here's the story. My neighbors told me that they were going to dump this animal because they had found it. It had been given to them by somebody who had found some puppies in the garbage can waiting for the garbage man to come and grind them to death live.
Oh, brother.
This is where we're at in the human race. And they took the pup, but they were going to throw it into a field where it would be eaten by more dogs that have no care. So I took him, and so we've got a rescue here, and this makes four dogs at the Corey household.
Wow.
But I thought it was very synchronistic with the fact that you're on tonight, and I'd like to get on with the show and then even talk about rescue and how important it is for us to help these animals.
Absolutely.
So before we get going, could you tell us a little bit about your background, how you became, first of all, how you became a vegetarian, which is not unlike my story. Let's start with that. How did you become a vegetarian?
Well, I took a couple years off in the 90s to travel, and I ended up in India, and I was living in the Himalayas with a Buddhist family, and I was a meat eater, of course, at that time, and everything that I ate came out of their garden, and I was essentially a de facto vegan, and I felt fantastic, and I was living at 12,000 feet in the mountains, and I felt wonderful, and one day, a cow wandered into the garden, and we just looked at each other. It was kind of a mystical moment for me, and I realized that this being deserved to live as much as any human does, and I decided I would stop eating meat when I got back to the United States, and I did, and I, over a period of time, transformed into a vegan.
That's wonderful. I'll tell you my story, which is not unlike yours. I went to the, also a meat eater about 23 years ago, went to the butcher and complained that the, I just barely can stand to think about it, that the steaks that I had prepared the night before were tough, and what was the meaning of this, and, you know, we paid top dollar, et cetera. And he said, well, madam, you know, it really depends on how much this animal suffers at the kill. And it was, I said, I beg your pardon. And he said, well, there's a lot of adrenaline, and, you know, the more they suffer, the tougher the meat. And I just, it's like, how did you never think of this all of your life?
Yeah, that's one of the arguments.
It's quite amazing when this veil lifts. And the next day, I decided right then and there I would never eat meat again. And then the next day, it was near Easter time. I had a similar experience as yours. I was on the highway, and a car, I live in Italy. So there was a huge truck full of little baby lambs that were going to kill.
Right.
And they were looking out of the little slats with their little sweet faces, and I thought, what hypocrisy. We give our children little stuffed cute lambs as Easter gifts, and then we feed them little stuffed dead baby lambs.
Yeah, there really is an inconsistency in how we bring children up, and we give them books about you know, baby ducks and baby animals. We give them stuffed animals, as you say. They watch cartoons where animals are the stars, and then we feed them, you know, chicken nuggets and hot dogs and all these horrible things. And some children eventually make the connection and others don't. And sometimes when they make the connection later in life, they feel sort of betrayed. You know, how could my parents, how could my family do this to me? And it's quite an awakening for them.
Well, there's just so much ignorance even into the question of the essence of life, the essence of consciousness in animals. Many people don't believe animals even have a soul. This seems to be a question that will go on in the theological halls of debate for the rest of our existence.
Yeah, I have. I think that animals definitely have souls. I can't look at an animal today and think that they don't have a spirit and that they wouldn't go to an afterlife if I'm going to.
I think also that I think you'll agree with me. Not eating meat, of course, makes you more sensitive. I think that, you know, the actual physical aspect of having meat in your system lowers your vibration, takes you more further out of synchronicity and sensitivity to other life forms, other animals. The more you eat meat, the farther away you are from being sensitive to the life force of animals and the consciousness in animals.
I absolutely agree. You're consuming a corpse. You know, you're eating a dead thing.
I know. That's what I always tell people in my classes. You're eating dead animal flesh,
right?
And yet it's higher light body that you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, that is. That is kind of a contradiction, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Of course, we want to go. There's this real art of doing this, which I'm sure that you've mastered, which is being able to talk to people without preaching and without becoming so utterly devastatingly frightening that they tune out. But I can't help but tell people, you know, remember, it's dead animal flesh. And
right.
That, you know, that really gets it. You talk about striking at the roots, and, you know, we start from there.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think that we have to find a balance in how we approach people. I think it's important for animal activists to be friendly, to be approachable.
Yes.
But on the other hand, we have to tell the truth, and sometimes the truth is ugly.
Well, especially at this moment on our planet, there's so much untruth that standing up for any belief system that goes against the grain requires a lot of ruffling feathers. I hate to use an animal metaphor, but
right.
That is what we're doing here. So my congratulations to you for being such a leader in this very important quest to help people wake up.
Oh, well, thanks. I kind of look at myself as a conduit for activists around the world. I interviewed about 120 of them and put their thoughts and their successes into book form to inspire others. So I really see myself as a vessel for all of their work.
Well, it's an amazing book. It's so full of money. Sorry about that. It's so full of wisdom and context, and it's just like a diary or a compendium of information for people that want to really get involved. So I'd like to start. Don't know why that money comment flipped in there, but anyway.
I don't make any money on the book.
I always try to tell people that usually people that are writing books like I am too for causes and dedicated niche market thinkers, we don't make money on books.
No.
Let's talk about the preface is, what are we fighting for? And can you give us a general introduction to basically what is the fight that animal active, presuming, of course, that people have a general idea of what we're talking about, but give us more insights into what PETA and other major organizations are really doing out there now.
Sure. Well, non-human animals are the most abused and exploited beings on the planet, and that abuse includes animal agribusiness. It's probably the first one most people think about, you know, factory farming and ocean-dwelling animals being pulled from the sea to become somebody's dinner, medical research, product testing. In both of these cases, animals are used to, you know, they're kept in cages and they're used to test either a product or they're experimented on, often without any pain relief. There's also the fashion industry, which includes the use of wool and fur and leather and some people think of these as byproducts of animal agribusiness, and in fact they're not in many cases. There's the entertainment industry, which includes circuses and zoos. Animals are often trapped in the wild. If they're young, their parents or mother is killed, and they're exported to a far-off place, another country, and they're held against their will. They're trained to perform tricks that are not natural to them for human amusement. There's sports like dog and horse racing and rodeos and hunting, which doesn't seem like a sport to me, certainly. But
I don't get where that fits in as a sport.
Well, some people call it a sport, and you know, there's canned hunts where animals are kept on a small piece of land, and they're let go when the hunter approaches, and basically they're guaranteed a kill. And you know, that there's no sport in that. And companion animals are bred into an already crowded pet market, and so those are some of the highlights of the things that we're fighting against.
Oh boy. Okay, we're going to try not to get too emotional here, but it's so hard when we talk about these issues to not just feel so overwhelmed and to stay in. And you talk about this in the book, how to not get burned out when you're dealing with so much pain.
Right.
And what? Yeah. How do you handle this? Dealing with so much pain and suffering.
I think that the activists who are the most successful, and that is the ones who stay in it the longest, are the ones who manage to find a balance. You know, we're trying to be superheroes, but we're really just humans, and so we need to find a way to be active and at the same time protect ourselves and not do too much. So the formula that I developed from my observations of other activists and for myself, I call the ACTIVE approach. That's ACTIVE, and each letter in the word stands for one of the steps. And so, for example, well, I'll just go through them if it's okay.
That's great.
A is allow yourself to be human. Animal activists we're not superheroes, so we need to give ourselves a break once in a while and you know, take a vacation, laugh with friends, have a good time, and try not to feel guilty about doing that. C is create something tangible to remind you of your victories, and that could be a file with your letters to the editor. It could be a scrapbook of a campaign you worked on. It could be a website. Anything that reminds you that you're being successful. T is talk to someone you trust. So this could be someone inside the movement, outside the movement, family, friends. If you have one person with whom you dare to be yourself, that is a gift. And animal activism is an emotionally loaded endeavor. And so it's important for us as sensitive people to unburden ourselves. I is ignore upsetting text and images, at least until you're feeling better. So
I'm sorry, would you repeat that one? I didn't get that.
Sure. It's ignore
uh-huh.
upsetting text and images, at least until you're feeling better. So that would be, you know, if you're feeling depressed and frustrated, and, you know, you've been working on a campaign or you're just feeling bad about something you read, for example, just put that aside for a while. You know, don't watch that horrible video. Don't watch Meet Your Meat, for example, on the PETA website. And I think my favorite is V, is visit an animal sanctuary. We have a lot of those in the United States, and I know that they have them in Australia and the UK. I don't know about other countries, but they're very popular. These are centers where farmed animals or other animals from maybe research labs have been rescued, and they're brought to a home, a piece of land, a farm, if you will, where they're allowed to live out their lives. And you can volunteer for these places. And I volunteer at an animal sanctuary here in California. And I am amazed by how many activists have never rubbed a pig's belly or whistled to a turkey to hear him gobble back or watched a hen take a dust bath. You know, hens in their natural environment, they love to be in the dirt, taking dust baths helps them to get rid of parasites. And so all these things that animals can do in nature if they were allowed to be free and not confined in these giant factory farms, activists can see on these sanctuaries. So I highly recommend that people do that. And the final step is exercise. I think it's really important that we get out, that we run, that we walk, that we hike, that we swim, bike, go to the gym, meditate, yoga, whatever we do. Do something for our bodies and our minds. Helps us release a lot of that energy. So those six things put together, I think, are a great formula for people to avoid getting burned out when they're involved in animal activism.
That sounds really balanced approach, but let me just ask you this. I mean, you're obviously an all-out activist. I'm sure that people do as best they can on whatever level they're working. So,
absolutely. Yeah, it doesn't take a lot of time. Yeah, you don't have to be me, for example, and I spend hours and hours a week in activism. You can just spend an hour a month.
I think just an important message to get out to people is, give as much as you can, give as much time as you can, and if that's only, an hour a month, it's so important that you do it.
Yeah, I mean, if everybody did that, if everybody on the planet took an hour a month to help animals, this world would be incredibly different.
Indeed. We had a guest on last week, Penelope Smith, who was talking about contact with the animal spirits when they pass to the other side, and I think she did a lot to sensitize people to that aspect that the animal has a soul, and like us, it has an afterlife, and that we need to be aware of that connection on all levels.
Yes, I agree.
So what do people do? I personally, my niece is very interested in animal conservation and activism, and I know she's listening, so what do you recommend people that want to contact animal shelters and places like that you mentioned in California?
Mm-hmm.
Or anywhere else? How do they connect?
Well,
do you have that information on your site?
Yes, there are many links on my site. If you just go to strikingattheroots.com and you click on the links tab, you'll find a number of places. They're also listed in the book. But you can also do an online search, depending on where you live. For example, if you live in the United States, you could just go onto Google and type in animal sanctuaries in the state where you're living. And you just do some research, locate one, or you can visit my website and go on to the contact me, contact the author page, and send me a question. I'll be happy to answer it.
Great. Okay, so that again, your website is, for those of you who just tuned in, it's Mark Hawthorne, and the website is www.strikingattheroots,
yep.
Right?
Yes, with an S.
.com. So let's get moving here, people. Let's also talk about this. I mean, besides there are so many levels of tuning into this very important aspect of our lives now. One of them is, at a very superficial level, the diseases that animals now are carrying. And a reason for not eating meat, if we're not going to go all the way into the deeply profound caring for other living beings, let's just talk about superficial aspects like what you can pick up now from eating meat.
Absolutely. That's definitely one of the main arguments for being a vegetarian. The first one being, don't eat animals because you don't want to contribute to cruelty. Another one being animal agribusiness is one of the largest contributors to greenhouse gases in the world. But the third is your own health. Eating meat can lead to cancer, heart disease, stroke, certainly obesity. I mean, there's a number of health problems that a human being can acquire. There's an argument whether or not we're meant to eat meat, and I try not to get into that argument because I don't think it's that important. I know there's a lot of
activists. Yeah, I agree with you, and it's an endless tunnel.
Yeah.
When you start to discuss that, people obviously are going to respond with, well, there's such a food shortage now, which I also don't agree with, and if you start not eating meat, what will people eat?
Right. Well, I think that, we put so many resources into raising livestock, and we do clear cutting of forests so that we can raise soybeans or whatever so that animals can eat. We put so many resources into raising meat. It takes 16 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of beef. Well, those 16 pounds of grain going to one animal to produce 1 pound of beef could be used for human mouths. And so that argument doesn't hold water for me. But,
yeah.
And
16 grain. That is, I didn't know those statistics.
Yeah, 16 pounds of grain. And there are many similar statistics regarding water resources and other energy resources. And the UN in late 2006 put out a report that showed that animal agribusiness was responsible for more global warming than all the transportation in the world combined. All the planes, cars, trucks, everything. All the methane that the animals produce is all those things. All the transportation combined is less than what all animal agribusiness contributes to global warming.
Well, now when you say animal agribusiness, let's make sure that people understand what you're talking about.
Well, I'm talking about the business of raising animals for food. And some of the definitions could be factory farming or what are called CAFOs, which are confined animal feeding operations. That's what the industry calls them. So there's these giant factories, essentially. They've moved animals from the farm. They've moved them from the small farms that many of us are familiar with from decades ago. And they've moved them indoors. And they started doing this in the 1950s. And they found that by giving animals less room to move around, they ate less feed, and they produced more meat, or more eggs, or more milk. And so as they realized that this was the case, factory farming has become the norm. So, you know, Old MacDonald's farm is a myth. There's very, very few small family farms now that are really effective. Now it's all these giant multinational corporations like Tyson or ConAgra or whatever that are producing most of the quote-unquote animal products, you know, meat, eggs, and dairy.
You want to give people some scary information about how small these cages are?
Well, I have been inside of a battery cage shed, for example, doing a rescue in California.
You're talking about egg-laying?
Yes, egg-laying hens. And basically they have about 67 square inches per bird. And a hen needs at least 72 inches just to spread her wings. Now, these cages are about the size of a file cabinet drawer. And there's 6 to 8 birds in a cage.
Oh, God.
These birds are denied all their natural instincts. The tips of their beaks are cut off without any pain relief so that they don't hurt each other. They stand on wire. They cannot spread their wings. They cannot nest. You know, there's no place for them to lay eggs naturally. And in many cases, they are stacked in tiers. In other words, there's maybe 2 or 3 or 4 high, and the birds on the top levels defecate and urinate on the birds below. And that's how these animals live, in darkness, breathing ammonia, for between 1 and 2 years. And
why are they breathing ammonia?
Because there's manure pits below, and the as the feces disintegrates, it releases ammonia. And you find this in factory farms where they're raising meat chickens too. They call them broiler chickens. This is the case as well. You walk into these places and you're just assaulted by ammonia. It burns your eyes, and these animals are breathing it, and that therefore they feed them with fill them up with antibiotics as well.
And therefore we're getting it as well.
Right.
All right. Now I just want to say to the people that are listening, I know this is not easy to hear, and it's painful, and it's sometimes you feel like, listen, I'm not going to listen to this, and I'm going to turn the channel. But just remember, this is reality, and we need to know the truth before we can do anything to make changes. So be strong and hear the truth so you can do something about it.
Yeah.
Okay, that's my...
No, that's an excellent point. And it's not pretty. It's definitely not. I've been inside factory farms. I've done rescues, and I've worked with animals who are abused, and I have 5 rabbits at home who are special needs rabbits because they were abused or neglected in some pretty horrible ways. Yet, living with these animals, I see so much hope. I see how easily they can come to trust humans again, and I find a lot of encouragement in that. And there is hope out there, and if we work together, if we are compassionate enough to spend, as I say, even an hour a month doing something about it, we can make a difference. And agribusiness and the entertainment industry, the fashion industry, sports industry, they're all nervous about animal activism. They don't like what we do because they know we're effective.
Yeah, in fact, in the book you talk so much about how to deal with persecution, basically, how to deal with police, how to deal with reactive forces against the work. And I would love you to share some of these points with people so that they know what they're up against and what you're up against as an activist.
Yes, well, I included an appendix in the book that deals with the civil rights of some of the countries around the world in which the book would be readily available. And every country is a little different, but basically, I think the best advice is if you encounter a law enforcement official and you're in the act of activism that you believe to be legal, you don't need to say anything. Get yourself an attorney, and don't admit any guilt, because as far as you're concerned, you haven't committed any crime.
Oh, excuse me for interrupting you, but you're talking about actually in a situation where you've gone in and done a rescue.
No, I'm talking about a situation where you're maybe in a public place and you're distributing information about animal rights or veganism or something, and maybe a store owner nearby is upset, and so they call the police, and the police come over and talk to you. And in some cases, you might be arrested. I don't know. It depends on the country. I'm not an expert on the various civil rights. Law.
Well, in the U.S. today, would you be arrested?
Well, probably not. I don't think you would. I think you would have to be doing something destructive in order for the police to have cause to arrest you. And I think my advice holds true for that instance as well. If you find yourself arrested, you need to get a lawyer, basically. You need to keep your mouth shut and get yourself an attorney. But I don't want to dissuade people. I don't want to discourage people. I don't want to frighten people into thinking that that's what's going to happen to you. That's very
no, I don't want to frighten people either, but I think that they need to know how hard people are working. And what, in my experience, so many people that are out there really working hard to make this a better world are facing so much personal danger and risk, and they do this willingly and lovingly and proudly and convinced, because they're committed people. So it's important for people to know that you don't do this, you don't take this lightly, and you are putting yourselves at risk.
Right.
And not so much they need to know what could happen to them, but they need to understand that getting behind organizations like PETA and the many more that you name in the book means supporting people who are like the Greenpeace people hanging off the ship on ropes.
Right, right.
And you can support them by money, you can support them by so many ways, but being aware of what peril people are doing, putting themselves in for their beliefs, I think is very empowering rather than frightening.
Yeah, there are people out there like Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society who actively goes out and chases down Japanese whaling ships. And he's been arrested any number of times, and he's, you know, he's been in jail, he's been beaten, he's been shot at, and he's one of my heroes. He's out there doing the good work, and he's just a great activist, and he's a great example of what one person, one committed person can do for animals in the world.
That's so true. And what is the situation now with the whaling in Japan?
I'm not sure what the exact situation is. I know that at their last whaling expedition, the Japanese came back short. I think they got about half of the whales they were hoping to, and I think that that is in no small part to animal activists.
I wonder if it's also because the whales are beaching themselves and just so tired of so much. Well, I think that the sound that's being used under in the oceans is really doing immense damage to the whales and the dolphins.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, our government in the United States is responsible for that, too. That's unfortunate.
Yeah. Is there any activism against that?
Well, that is a great example of outreach that people can get involved in, and you can learn about what your own military is doing. your own government is doing. In the United States, for example, the USDA has an offshoot called Wildlife Services, and this is a part of the U.S. government that goes out and traps and kills animals on public land. And they generally do it because these animals are either competing with forage for livestock animals, or they're just nuisance animals. They might be coyotes, for example, that go after sheep or goats or something. But the Wildlife Services will also kill an animal for eating somebody's flowers or for frightening somebody. And I don't think many people know that their tax dollars are being used for that. So that's just one example of how you can, something that you can be upset about that your government, at least the United States government, is doing. So I think that you can definitely talk to policymakers. You can talk to your elected officials. And I think arming yourself with information is important. You need to be aware of what's going on, first of all, to be upset about it.
That's right.
Going to a website like PETA's or another organization's site in your native country is important, and learning about the issues that are going on locally, and then contacting policymakers, whether that's an elected official or whether it's a company that is doing animal testing or in other ways abusing animals and you want to see it stopped. Your voice counts, whether it's because it's a vote or because it's a dollar. Your voice counts, and it's important to let people who are in the position of making decisions know how you feel.
No, I absolutely agree with you 1,000%. I'm glad that you encourage this to make people understand that one call, that one signature makes a difference. And sometimes we feel so overwhelmed that we don't really think we can, so we don't make it.
I think, Patricia, one of the reasons it's so important is that most people don't write letters. Most people don't make phone calls. And editors know this, elected officials know this, so that when some person takes the time to write a letter or send an email or pick up the phone and talk to a policymaker, they realize that that person speaks for a much larger group, the group that doesn't pick up the phone or doesn't send a letter. So you might think, oh, if I send a letter to the editor and it doesn't get published, it means I wasted my time. And that's not true. You know, you are educating that editor, and you're letting the staff know that there's a group of people who are interested in this particular topic. And the same is true with elected officials. They know that most people aren't going to write to them. Most people aren't going to call them. So if you call an elected official or you write to them, they look at that as a vote. You know, they say, this is somebody who really cares enough to take the time to do this. I'm going to pay attention to that person. I'm going to pay attention to this
issue. Do you
think
so? I mean, considering the lobbies that they've got pushing them to...
Yeah, I do think so. I understand. It's overwhelming. You know, we've got so many lobbyists who push for things like here in the United States, the Farm Bill, and things like that. But I do think it does make a difference, yes.
Well, let's hear it for optimism. We're talking to Mark Hawthorne. His wonderful book is called Striking at the Roots, A Practical Guide to Animal Activism. If you've just tuned in, his website is strikingattheroots.com. And I'm going to be opening up shortly for call-ins. So get your pens, and let me give you the toll-free number to call in if you'd like to give some questions to Mark. The toll-free number in the States is 877-876-5227. And I'll give it to you again, 877-876-5227. Please call in and have this opportunity to speak to one of the key people in this fight for the animals on our planet. All right, now I've got a question for you.
Yes.
So now we're being faced with cloned animals for the food supply. What do you have to say about this, first of all, about the cloning in general, and what this means as far as what you're going to be ingesting when you're eating cloned meat?
Well, I think that exploiting animals in any form is wrong. I don't believe that we should be using animals to eat or to wear or to entertain us or anything else. So as far as cloning animals, I don't think we should be doing that because it's exploiting an animal. As far as the safety of the food is concerned, my understanding is that that's inconclusive. I don't think that they have shown that that is really safe, and it's such a new thing. I know that some agencies have declared that it's safe to eat, but how do we know? How do we know that 10 years down the line, you're not going to acquire some new disease or cancer or something else? There's just, they've told us many times that certain animals are safe, that we're, the food supply is safe, and yet we constantly have issues with mad cow disease, and there's bird flu, and there's all these other issues involved, that other diseases that animals acquire. So I don't think that anybody can say with certainty that cloned animals are safe to eat.
Well, first of all, the associations that are telling us that it's safe are probably unsafe.
Absolutely. They have a definite monetary interest in what they're saying.
Exactly. And yeah, we've certainly seen in the last 10 years particularly that the food supply is anything but safe. And
absolutely.
Particularly bad, of course, are the animal products.
Right, and as we spoke earlier, eating them is bad for you. So whether or not the food is so-called safe, I don't think down the line it is. I don't think that having rotting beef in your colon is good for you, for example. It's not good to ingest milk. I mean, we're the only species on the planet that drinks milk of another species and drinks it after we've been weaned. So does that seem natural? No, it's not natural yet.
And I have to tell you, I do occasionally drink milk. Because
well,
I live in a
Tricia,
country...
we're going to have to talk about that.
I know, you're going to have to really help me. Because I live in Italy, and we've got cappuccino, and I've got a really dear friend, Damien, who is also an animal activist, and he keeps talking to me about the milk, and I just haven't been able to stop. But talking to you now and reading your book, I think it's going to be much easier to let that go as well.
I think that the suffering that animals endure in the dairy industry and the egg industry are worse than anything that happens in the raising of meat. And just to speak about dairy cows for a moment,
this is going to do it to me, right?
Well, I'm just trying
to... Go ahead.
I
can handle it.
Give you the information. But, you know, these animals are inseminated every year so that they lactate, so that they're kept pregnant, so that they give milk, and their babies are taken away a day or less after birth. The females go back into the dairy industry. The males either become veal or they become beef cows. They're generally not meat animals. You know, it's not like they're going to be good meat animals, but they're definitely killed. And the female cows who are giving the milk last about 5 years until their bodies are exhausted, and then they're sent off for slaughter. And they're so depleted, their bodies are so depleted that they are basically used for hamburger. They can't be worth anything more than that. And a cow in nature will live about maybe 20 to 25 years. So you're talking about one-fifth of her lifespan. She's spent imprisoned in a factory farm on a milk machine, and then all her babies are taken away, and the separation of the mother cow and the baby cow is just unbelievable. It is heart-rending to hear the crying of the two animals when they're separated. And I just, when I learned about the dairy industry and the egg industry, that's when I decided I couldn't support that anymore. I had to go from vegetarian to vegan and not support those industries.
Mm. It's so important that you do what you can and you progress as best you can. And as I said, I don't preach to anyone other than telling people to remember they're eating dead animal flesh. But yes, I do see that without ever wanting to be not walking my talk, the milk has to go. Even though it's not a lot of milk, it's still the milk. So, you know,
right,
let's not split hairs here.
And somebody who
gives, we have to invent a soya-based cappuccino.
Hey,
soya milk.
Soya milk is great, and there's not a substitute available for something. What I mean is that every animal-based product has a substitute, whether it's fake meat or soy milk or vegan ice cream, or you can even cook without eggs. I don't think they have a good, maybe fried egg. That may be the exception. But you can have tofu scramble. I mean, there's so many
options. You can live without the fried egg.
Absolutely. When I learned what happens to the hens in the egg industry, absolutely, I couldn't support that.
Now let me ask you this from a purely philosophical point of view. If you had your own chickens, would you eat the eggs?
No, I wouldn't.
If they were free-ranging and happy, you still would
eat them? No, I wouldn't. No, but I'll tell you that the sanctuary where I volunteer, it's called Animal Place. And anybody who's interested in looking at the website, it's animalplace.org. And they're here in California. And we have, I don't know, 200 chickens probably. And there's a number of hens, and they do lay eggs, and Animal Place collects the eggs. And they do occasionally give them to volunteers who eat eggs. And I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing, because the animals themselves aren't really being exploited. But I just decided I wasn't going to eat any eggs, so I don't see the need. I'm completely...
It's just history.
Yeah, it's out of my system. It doesn't appeal to me whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about plants and the consciousness in plants? Because, of course, people go to that next issue, well, then, if you don't want to eat meat, why do you eat plants? They have feelings, too.
Yeah.
And, of course, we've seen some remarkable, if you remember, Marcel Vogel did some pretty wonderful experiments with connecting plants with electroencephalograms.
Right.
And seeing them react to human behavior.
I have a two-part response to that when somebody asked me. The first is that plants do not have nerve endings. They don't have a central nervous system. They don't have a mechanism to get away from pain stimuli. So I don't think they feel pain. But part two is, if you believe the plants feel pain, then being vegetarian is a better resource for you, because the biggest consumer of plant life in the world is livestock. We raise plants to feed to livestock. And so if you're really concerned about the feelings of plants, don't eat animals.
Touché. This is a wonderful answer. And, you know, my answer to people when they do say that to me is, I do the best I can.
Mm-hmm.
And when I eat a salad or whatever vegetables I eat, I bless the food and try to stay in the highest consciousness as possible and do as least amount of damage as possible, because we also do need to eat.
Right. Well, and none of us is perfect, Patricia. And I do stress that when I give talks. We need to realize that everything we consume, even if you're vegan, everything we consume at some level harms animals or insects. And so try not to be preachy. Don't be sanctimonious, because...
Yeah, no, I never have. I really think that's so important, because it's such a turnoff for people.
Yeah.
It's like a former smoker. You just don't want to hear them.
No. And the animals don't need our purity. And so don't let perfection get in the way of being an effective advocate.
Touché again. Tell me more about, we've talked about PETA quite a bit. Can you give me some more names so that people that maybe haven't got your book now can start doing some investigating on the Internet and see what other societies and associations are working for animal activists?
Absolutely. Well, in Australia, there's Animal Liberation Victoria, and there's Animals Australia. And in Canada, there are a number of organizations, Canadian Voice for Animals, there's Earth Save Canada, there's Fur Bearer Defenders.
Boy.
There's the Toronto Vegetarian Association.
Do you work with all of these organizations?
I have been in touch with all of them, and they all had input. Yes, I interviewed all of them.
Wonderful.
And in New Zealand, there's... Animal Rights New Zealand, there's Auckland Animal Action.
And so all of these organizations are, let's say, working together in some way, or interconnected?
They're all organizations working to advance the interests of animals. So that's what they have in common. It's not that they're related in any way. Like PETA, for example, is worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to PETA.org, you're going to find offices all over the world. These organizations are smaller, but they're located in the countries that I name. Like, for example, in New Zealand, there's another organization called Save Animals from Exploitation. In other words, SAFE. In fact, I think their website is safe.org.nz. and there's other countries don't have a lot. There's South Africa, for example. I think there's only one animal rights organization, Animal Rights Africa. And then in the UK and in Europe, there are so many. There's Animal Aid, which is basically the PETA of the UK. There's the British Union for the Abolition of Vivisection. There's Compassion in World Farming.
And, of course, there's your book, which will give everybody, I'm sure, there are just, everything is listed in the book, so that people really need to get this book, because it's just so full of everything they need to have. It's like a compendium. That's what I would call it. You've got everything from vegan recipes to every kind of contact, information about lobbying. It's really remarkable work. What's your next book going to be about?
Well, I'm working on something that will give activists a tool into some insights into some of the lesser-known abuses that go on. I'm in the research phase of it right now, but we all hear about some of the big crimes. We all hear about the big issues, the fur industry and the agribusiness, etc. But some of the things that go on behind the scenes, maybe some things the government is doing that we're not aware of, that type of stuff. And again, this will be all over the world.
Mm-hmm. That's very courageous of you.
Yeah, I guess it is. I guess I could get in big trouble.
Yeah, well, a man's got to do what a man's got to do, as they say.
Well, yeah, do it for the
animals. I think that, you know, the mere idea of being an activist implies that you've got to be courageous.
Well, I just don't think there's any way else for me to live. I just really have to do this for people.
Yeah, it's like the courage is a byproduct of the mission, you know?
Yeah. I mean, these are beings who can't speak up for themselves for the most part, so I need to do it for them.
Mark, you've got a list in your book, 11 things you can do today to help animals. Can you remember what they all are? I'd like to share this with the audience.
Well, I can turn to my book. Let me see.
Okay, I'll give you the one-liner, and then you talk about it, okay?
Okay.
The first one is go vegan.
Right. And if you can't, try giving up meat, eggs, and dairy products one a week, and then add another day every week.
And I think that's a really good suggestion. That's also what I tell people. If it's just too overwhelming for you, just start. Just let yourself feel what it feels like not to have any meat gumming up your system for a week.
Number two is set up an account on a site like iGive.com or GoodSearch.com. And these sites allow you to support animal groups with a percentage of your online shopping. And I should stress, it doesn't cost you anything to do this. So you can go to iGive.com or GoodSearch.com. And these are search engines that allow you to do your online shopping, but they give a portion of your purchase to the organization that you pick.
Okay, that's really fantastic. I didn't know about that, and that is, of itself, one of the most important things we can tell people tonight.
Yeah, and it doesn't cost them anything.
Great.
And there's lots of organizations on there, and just because I support animal groups doesn't mean I don't support other groups, and I'm sure your listeners have their own charities that they like to support, so they can, if they wanted to, choose one of those instead, of course.
That's true, but we hope that they're going to do something for the animals.
Yes.
All right,
do.
Number three?
Number three is contact a local animal shelter or sanctuary and ask about volunteering. And, you know, we discussed that earlier.
Yeah, and I'd like to add one little 3A in here, a little Pat Corey tip, and that is this. If you take on an animal, take it on for its life. This is not a toy. It's not I'm talking about domestic animals now. If you bring an animal into your family, make sure you're committed that this isn't going to become old and be abandoned. I feel very strongly about this, having just pulled a dog almost out of the garbage can.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and I want to add to that. There's a person that I was speaking with who works in an animal shelter, and she was telling me that they had a woman bring in a cat who, I don't remember if she bought it from a pet store or if she adopted it from the shelter, but she brought the cat back because it didn't match the curtains. So,
oh, my God. Are
yeah.
you kidding? You can't be serious.
No, unfortunately I am.
This is pushing me over the limit.
Yeah. So, people, I totally agree. If you bring an animal into your home, he or she is part of your family, and please.
And they give you unconditional love. Just give it back.
Yeah.
For the lifetime of the animal, you don't get to dump the animal on the side of the road because you're going on vacation here. Okay.
Well, and rabbits is a great example of that. Every year around Easter, people buy rabbits for their kids, and then when the novelty has worn off, they dump them in the park or they drop them off at a shelter, and you know, these animals are treated as toys, as commodities.
Yeah, well, the vet today told me when I went in to take care of this new pup that he said, people put 6 or 7 puppies in a bag and tie it to our fence and wait for us to open.
Yeah.
Okay, that's preaching. I stopped there. Okay, let's get on with this because we're almost out of time. Number four.
Okay. Number four is order leaflets from PETA or Vegan Outreach and begin leafleting when they arrive. And the whole first chapter of my book is about leafleting, just going to a college campus or something. Number five, ask your school cafeteria or one of your favorite restaurants to carry vegan entrees.
And this would be wonderful also because you'll get more health in the children.
Right, absolutely. Number six is write a letter to the editor of your local paper. Number seven, visit your local bookstore and pick up a book on animal rights. Number eight is visit, I list a number of sites here where you can order a vegetarian starter kit and give it to a meat-eating friend. And listeners can just go to Google and type in vegetarian starter kit, and they'll find it. Number nine is if you have companion animals who are not spayed or neutered, make an appointment with the animal's veterinarian to have this done. Number 10 is order buttons.
Okay, let me interject something here. Mm-hmm. A lot of associations do this for free, and so if money is an issue, you can possibly find someone who's going to be able to do this for free. And today when I went to the doctor with my new abandoned pup, I asked him to at least split the cost with me for this session because I was rescuing the animal, and he did it for free.
Oh, that's nice.
So
ask. Yeah, that's a good point. And number 10 is order buttons and shirts with anti-cruelty messages. And people can do this from groups like PETA or HSUS or Animal Aid or whatever. And finally, number 11 is include a signature line in your email with links to one or two of your favorite animal rights videos or current campaigns. You know, it's amazing how many activists don't even do this. Just doing an auto signature in your email that lets people know where they can go for a vegetarian starter kit or linking them to a video or a campaign. So that's a very easy thing. So these are all things people can do right away to help animals.
That's great. I want to remind you all, those of you who are listeners to this program, that we are all talking about and aspiring to raising our consciousness and becoming light body beings. And this issue is not going to go away or just because we don't want to think about it or look at it or somehow peer into that dark place where there's so much cruelty. But the buck stops here. We have to do something about this crisis. We have to support people like Mark. We have to teach the children. They are the future. So please, please read this wonderful book, Striking at the Roots. I can't speak well enough about it. A Practical Guide to Animal Activism. The author is Mark Hawthorne. His website is Striking at the Roots, like the book, .com, and it will definitely change your view on eating meat if you're still doing it, and drinking milk in your cappuccino if you're still doing that,
right?
And how you can make the world a better place for the creatures that share this space many times more elegantly than we do. Mark, thank you for being with me. Believe it or not, we're done.
Time's up. Thank you very much, Pat. I appreciate you having me on your show.
It's been wonderful having you, and I'm going to be hoping you'll be coming back on, especially when your new book comes out. But even before then, you just call me anytime you've got something to say, and I will get you on the air.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay, and please also, everybody, remember my website is SyrianRevelations.net, and the books, my books are the Syrian Revelations. On my site, which is soon to be restructured, there's a link called The Human Voice. And I'm going to ask Mark to submit an article to that category so that you can read more about what he has to say about what we've just glossed over tonight. Okay, that's it for tonight. Thank you, Mark, again, and I will definitely be in touch with you.
Thank you, Pat.
Keep up your good work, and please tell everyone that you're working with that you have a friend and a fellow fighter here in Italy.
All right, thank you. I will.
Okay, good night, everyone. It's night here again. That's why I always say good night. Goodbye, everyone, and be with me next week. We're going to have another dynamic show. We'll be talking about striking. Oh, that's you striking. We'll be talking about the United Symbolism of America and how the symbols in and hidden meanings are laced throughout the fabric of that culture. And I know you're going to want to be listening to that. Okay? Take care. Take care of your animals and watch what you put into your mouth. Good night.